Hello, you are listening to episode 3 in the podcast series of How to Run Stripe HIV Workshops. This episode is about running the small group discussions and setting up and managing the groups and making sure that the discussions are more effective to enhance learning. My name is Marieke de Villiers and with me I have Ian Cooper and Francois Coutier. So let's start. How do you deal with setting up the small groups in the workshops? For instance, how many participants should be in a group and how many groups should a workshop have?
So the group discussions are the most important part of the workshops in the way that the modules have been designed by the Stripe AfriHealth team. Therefore, we give a lot of attention to this and setting them up so we don't just let them happen by accident. How many groups we have depends on the number of participants, but what we always aim for is a maximum group size of about 7. So sort of 5 to 7 in a group is good. If we get into 8, we'll want to start splitting more to ensure that everyone can participate fully. And then we decide on the number of groups on the basis of that. And we deliberately engineer the groups rather than allowing participants to choose themselves.
So can you explain what you mean by you engineering the groups?
Yeah, so what we mean is that we structure the groups very carefully. We look at the issues of professional background, the level, you know, that students versus professionals. We look at the issue of gender and demographics when we establish the groups. So if I can maybe go on to talk a little bit about that process, we know that people gravitate to the people they know and they are comfortable with if you allow them to set up their own groups, and you'd land up with a group of doctors, professionals, and a group of medical students and a group of nursing students, etc. So what we usually do is when people come in, we let them sit anywhere, but we warn them not to get too comfortable, and we maybe do some of the introductions, overall introductions then. But at this time, let's just get a feel for how many people have actually arrived. We tried to know this beforehand, but it doesn't always work out. And then we ask about what are the backgrounds of the people in the room, and we get an idea of the numbers from different backgrounds and at different levels. So, for example, if we have a group of 50 people and we want to have about 7 groups, and there happens to be 7 professional nurses in the group, then we say, okay, 7 groups, 7 professional nurses, we use that as our base. Other times maybe a group of students. Sometimes there isn't a group that links nicely to the number of separate groups that we want, and then we'll just choose random individuals. But then we'll put these people around the room, say these 7 people in different parts, and then we'll ask, okay, who are the medical students here? All stand up, and we'll allocate, maybe there are 14 medical students, so 2 go to each group. Pharmacists, maybe they need 2 pharmacists, so we put the pharmacists in separate groups, etc. But we do this whole allocation process to ensure that there's a spread of people from different backgrounds. We have in one case where we actually had the privilege of having enough facilitators for 1 facilitator for each group to use the facilitators as our base person for making that group happen. Then once these groups have established, we say, okay, choose a table, get together around the table, get to know each other, and you know, start your process of group formation, essentially.
Yeah, just to add to that, you can also use the facilitator's background to fill out certain absences in a group. Mm. So if you have too few pharmacists, for example, if one of the facilitators is a pharmacist, you can place that person at a table that doesn't have a pharmacist. And the same for the other professions.
Okay. So actually you're working with the diversity as a strength to prevent homogenous groups. Mm-hmm. Is there a little exercise that you can do, like a little icebreaker in the beginning? I've heard that some people say you stand in a group and then if you are this, you must step forward, and if you are that, you must step backward. Have you done that or not really?
I mean, that sounds like a nice idea. We haven't tried something like that. We do, and we get people to introduce it themselves to each other. We give them, you know, a bit of a tool for introducing themselves, which might vary, such as, you know, tell people something unusual about yourself, or something like that. That's go beyond the sort of professional background.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, on the topic of icebreakers, one of our local facilitators in Uppington feels that that's quite an important part of the workshop. So he makes quite use of icebreakers to get people comfortable and talking.
So what suggestions do you have to get participants talking and enthusiastic about the workshop? Because maybe they've been tired working and now they must come and sit down for a two-day workshop. So how do you do that?
I think we've spoken already about creating an overall atmosphere, an environment that's non-judgmental, that's inclusive. But to focus on the groups themselves, as I said, we have a time for them to get to know each other and encourage them in that to use first names and not titles so that everybody is the same. We encourage them to write their names on their name tags in that way so that we are establishing that as the process. Most of the workshop activities are done in small group discussions, as I said, and sometimes we will have facilitators per group who can keep the discussions going, or we ask the groups themselves to take that responsibility. Maybe they'll choose a facilitator themselves out of the group whose role will be to make sure that those discussions keep going. We get people to use the resources we've provided for them and also their smartphones or other devices in terms of looking up things. So sometimes you will see a group of people huddled around somebody's phone or something as they're all trying to look at some information together, or somebody reading from their phone to the rest of the group, so that it's not a withdrawing to look up information, but it's, again, it's a shared process in the group. And we also try to be flexible with time. So although we set times for each activity, where we see groups are very engaged, we encourage that and we allow them some extra time to do it if we can. But we also need to look at the fact that sometimes energy levels get low. You know, the sessions are intense, they're long, and sometimes as we're coming up for lunchtime or end of the afternoon or something like that, we take a break or we do something different. Sometimes we'll actually say, okay, we'll finish this module after lunch. We had that in one of the workshops because It was just too much for people. So that willingness, I think, to be flexible in terms of the way that we do things. Perhaps a little incentive. Hopefully the workshop should be enough to encourage people to talk themselves, but certainly having continuing professional development or continuing education points for participants in the workshop also helps to keep them interested and motivated.
Yeah, together with that, the attendance register.
Attendance register, yeah. So just in context, in South Africa, all health professions should gather a number of continuing professional development points in order to re-register at the regulatory council. But you can use other things also, like certificates and those kind of things as
The Stripe allows for people who've participated to download certificates for themselves from the website after they've completed.
That's great.
Okay, now we get to group feedback. How do you manage that?
This is the issue of how we get each of the groups to give feedback to the whole workshop, to all the other participants. We try to ensure that different people give feedback every time, because otherwise, you know, you'll have the same spokesperson per group each time. We ask the groups to do that, but as the facilitator for a module, one also tries to do that. And if groups are not doing it themselves, one intervenes and chooses somebody else and say, please, can so-and-so report back. so that we are hearing different voices all the time. And it's quite difficult when it's very big, but to try and pick up the people who haven't spoken and making sure that they have a chance to speak. It's a balance in terms of time, because one doesn't want each group to give a whole feedback. So we try and pick up maybe one or two points from each group. In some cases, when we've got 7 or 8 groups, it's too much to get a feedback from each group. So then we might ask, in terms of one activity, let 4 or 5 of them give feedback, and then the next activity, another 4 or 5 to give feedback, rather than having everybody give feedback all the time. Also, change up who speaks first. So whether one actually numbers groups and then starts at 1 and then at 2 and then at 3, or just randomly picks, but we try and do things like that. And if you want to add to that, Francois?
Yeah, just to explain something about activities. Sometimes there's 2 or 3 or even 4 questions within activity, and then some of those questions can be allocated to different groups, and they answer those. And especially when time is a bit of an issue, we sometimes allow 2 or 3 out of the 7 groups to answer the question rather than having repetition.
Okay, I see. So how do you manage to keep the attention of the other groups when one group is giving feedback? Sometimes the other groups, they start talking amongst themselves. Is there something, advice you have?
Depending on time, but sometimes we can ask them to respond to just what was said. They think that is a feasible option or practical.
Always say, you know, please only add and don't repeat what has been said by previous groups, which also makes them pay attention.
Or you can say they can give the other group points for their feedback.
So we haven't tried that. Maybe that's something we should
do. That's an idea. Because then they will listen.
Yeah, so that's also sometimes where the flip chart's useful.
Okay.
Is to just have another facilitator using the flip chart to record some of the points that were given in the feedback.
So what you're saying then, you are interacting with the small group, giving the feedback, and somebody else is just recording the points on the flip chart.
Yes.
Okay, so in that sense, you remain in eye contact and... Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, that happened almost by accident. We were just by realizing that the facilitator running, trying to write the things up and engage with the groups was just too much. So we naturally evolved to that, which
Good. Okay, so then how do you ensure participants to stick to the rules? We've talked about ground rules in the podcast 2 and a little bit here. But how do you get them to stick to the rules and the time limits?
We rely on the groups to monitor themselves, but we are clear on the time. We remind groups and we tell them you've got 2 minutes left, or you know, you need to stop now or whatever, so that we are also engaged in that. We, of course, have to keep ourselves on track, and the facilitators, a team, will nudge each other sometimes in terms of that, because if we go over time, it undermines the process and it breaks rules.
Okay.
If we've set up ground rules about timekeeping, so that's why, as we mentioned earlier, a facilitator might get wrapped over the knuckles by the participants for not doing what we said we would do.
Yeah, initially we thought of doing 4 modules a day, but we found that would be far too much. And if you choose 3 modules, it allows a bit of extra time for each module, that you can kind of budget for going over time a little, and that does help with those time restrictions. So although the activities have time suggestions, like 5 minutes or 10 minutes per activity, we find those a bit restrictive, so we often go a bit longer than the suggested time.
Another tool that we use in family medicine is something called signposting. So when you are going over time, maybe just to signpost to the audience, I am noticing that we are going over time, but for this reason, because this is an important topic, I see that you are passionate, let's give it some extra time, because there will be people who will be worried you are going over time and you're not realizing it.
Yes, that's a good...
Yeah, we very much try to keep all the participants on board rather than just making decisions without keeping people involved and informed.
Okay, have you covered that? You happy with that?
I think so.
Okay. So then, now, who are group facilitators, and can you talk a bit about their roles?
So I think we've mentioned a little bit of this already, but the idea is that each group needs to have a facilitator in order to keep the discussion going, to keep them focused, etc. And these might be appointed by the overall workshop facilitator or us as the leadership team, or it might be chosen by the groups. Either way, it's important that people understand the role. And that role is not about providing the answers, absolutely not. And certainly our experience has been in a few cases where we have new facilitators who are formally wanting to become ongoing facilitators of these workshops. Some of them are quite keen and they want to demonstrate, you know, how much they know, and they start dominating groups or starting to give answers, and we've got to step in and make sure that that, you know, doesn't happen, especially where those facilitators have been given the facilitator's guide, which is then they have the suggested answers in front of them, and they can easily start going into a teacher-student mode. So we work on that, and I think everybody in our experience so far does get into that. They might take a bit of time to that. But really, the role of the group facilitators at that level is to keep the other participants in their groups focused on the tasks required by each activity. It's easy, and we have seen it sometimes where people start veering off the topic and discussing unrelated things or even starting to talk about the weekend. I mean, we know how groups happen. It's so easily. So somebody needs to say, you know, hey, guys, let's come back to this for the group. But the other important thing is that the group facilitator must be making sure that a certain person or profession doesn't dominate the group. When we are talking about quite technical clinical things, it's easy for the doctors or the pharmacists, for example, to land up dominating. But that's not useful, and we need to help the groups for that not to happen so that everybody is involved. And the facilitator ideally should also help to ensure that different people are reporting back. In a sense, one can sell the facilitator role by saying, you'll never have to report back. Your job is just to make sure that all the other people in the group play that role. And so that they don't take on that role themselves.
So can I just clarify? So you would now have formed your groups. So there's two options, that there would be somebody in the group or there would be a facilitator from outside the group, am I correct?
Yeah. So that depends on how many people we have on board who are wanting to be workshop or module facilitators going forward.
See.
If we've got enough of them, then we can allocate one per each group. But most of the time, we don't have enough to do that. So we rather let the facilitators come from the groups and then we let the others float and go in to help when there's a need or an issue that's been noticed or something.
So when it's somebody, a participant from the group, then that person won't have a facilitator's guide then?
No.
And you usually meet with the people who's come forward to be facilitators beforehand, so they are a little bit more informed. I see. But for people who don't have that, they can then use your model for choosing somebody in the group. Does that person remain the facilitator for both days, or can they change roles?
That's variable. So, I mean, it can be if people are happy and want to carry on, but we can also change it. One can also do it per module and say, for this module, choose a facilitator. So, I mean, then over the 2 days, you'll have 6 facilitators.
Yes.
So everybody in the group, in a sense, has a chance then to be a facilitator.
Yes, okay.
So, yeah, all of those we've used at different times and in different ways.
Okay. Francois, something to add still?
Yeah, I think Ian's covered most of it. I've also found that sometimes a facilitator can just help that everybody's on the same page. Occasionally there would be some terminology that some of the therapy professions wouldn't understand if I can use iris as an example.
What is iris? Something in your eye.
Yeah, it's the immune reconstitution inflammatory
syndrome.
Forgot it almost myself. So the therapy students wouldn't necessarily know what that term is, but the facilitator can, for example, use the doctor or the medical students in the group to explain it and just encourage that that everybody is on the same page.
Yeah, it actually then draws on the different strengths in the group, make people feel equal. Okay, thank you. So that brings us to the end of episode 3. And just in summary, this was about running small group discussions in the STRIPE HIV workshops, setting up and managing the groups, and ensuring that discussions are more effective to enhance learning. Thank you.